This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter, at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
Well, happy Good Friday. See, to me, it's just a Friday. It's not really good, not really bad. It's just kind of a Friday. It's raining here. Steve, is it a good Friday for you?
It's average. Yeah.
Average.
Yeah.
Let's ask,
It's not bad.
We should ask our theist. How is your Good Friday going, sir? This is the day that... give us a synopsis of what Good Friday is, just real quickly.
Good Friday is the day that Jesus was crucified, died, and laid into a tomb.
Aha. Uh-huh. And tonight you are going to convince the nation and the world that Jesus really was crucified and that he rose again. That's correct, right?
I am. Hopefully. I am.
Excellent. I can't wait to hear. I teased a little bit before we started because we've done this. How many times have we done this debate, Steve? Would you say?
Oh, I don't know. I'm more concerned about how many times we're going to hear the word Josephus. That's all I really want to know.
Well, I was coming to that. By the way, is anyone else hearing double? Not that I'm complaining because I love the sound of my voice, but. Oh, Steve.
I'm muted.
Oh.
It's not me.
Well, maybe it'll fix itself. Now I don't hear myself. Okay, good. Like I said, not that I have a problem with that. We've done this debate probably, I would say, 7 times, 8 times. And it seems like every time we do it, the words Tacitus and Josephus increase in their use. And so tonight I'm going to be keeping track right here on my whiteboard of how many times we hear the words Josephus and how many times we hear the words Tacitus. And here's what we're going to do. If we're going to make a wager, if Josephus is said more times than Tacitus, then Steve will do a stream shirtless this summer. And if Tacitus is said more times than Josephus, I will. So there's our bet.
I'll just say Tacitus for 20 minutes.
Don't do that.
So that's who you want to see without a shirt on. Okay.
Don't do that.
And I will not be producing that day. Just saying.
I won't be watching. I can do it.
We'll put the sensor bars up in there. It'll be wholesome. I mean, it's just like you're going to the beach. You know what I mean? Okay. So as far as what's going on this weekend, of course, tomorrow we will be doing a fighter day as we always do. Sunday, it will be Jimmy and I, like it always is. And then going into next week, we have shows up until Thursday. Friday, I will be in Dallas for the Faithless Forum. And so I will be live streaming all of us getting drunk. You'll get to see as we go from place to place to place. I'll keep a story on that. And then Saturday, I'm sure we'll do something where we're all together because we're all going to be in that one central place. Dallas doesn't know what's about to hit them. I'm just going to tell you that. Aaron is already priming it. It's going to be fun. Other than that, Steve, do you have anything?
No, I'm good. I've just been reading the Mueller report lately. So hopefully maybe later on tomorrow or this weekend or so soon we could do a kind of episode on that. I would be down for that. There's some good stuff in here.
No collusion. I'm
actually reading it today.
Witch hunt.
No collusion.
Witch hunt.
I'm fucked.
I chose not to include that in anything I wrote today. I'd like to point that out. I was going to and I chose not to.
I'll tell you, following this, we will be doing an after show. Of course, both of our participants are invited, but we have quite the crew that's coming on for the after show. In a very bizarre twist and turn of events today, and I hope you both are able to join us. But we will have Paula Gia, Godless Engineer, Andrew from Twitter, and Master Supreme Apologist. Are going to be coming on to the after show. So brace yourselves because we're just getting started here. Maybe we can talk about the Mueller report then. See what Master Supreme Commander Apologist has to say about that. Let's take a second and let our two fine guests introduce themselves and tell us a little bit about who they are and why they do what they do and how we got to be here on this Good Friday. Let's start with Nathaniel. Hello, sir.
Hey, Kyle. How are you?
Fantastic.
Awesome. Well, I am Nathaniel Walters, and much to Steve's chagrin, I am an agnostic atheist.
he and I will never agree on that. I was the Texas Assistant State Director for American Atheists, and I regularly infiltrate Robert Jeffress' church so that I can expose him for the bigot that he is in downtown Dallas. And I also do a lot of this, speaking against young earth creationism, and also that's not this, but I do a lot of that. And then I speak with good folks like Dean, because I want to believe the things that I accept are true, and I want to ensure that we have a logical, rational debate with other people that they do the same thing as well. So that's why I do it.
Excellent. And Dean. Hello, Dean.
What's going on? My name's Dean Meadows. I'm the preacher at the Gastonia Church of Christ in North Carolina. I was in the Marine Corps for SEERS, one deployment to Iraq in 2006. And I currently am a part of a apologetics organization called the Daily Apologist with about six or seven other people. I do what I do because I'm like Nathaniel. I like to pursue truth wherever it might lead. And the way that we got here was actually Nathaniel commented on a post of mine. I don't even know how many years ago it was, a year and a half ago, 2 years or something like that. We posted a blog about the Kalam, and he said something about it. I forget what he said. I think he said that he agreed with me on it. I think that's what he said. Just kidding.
So this has been brewing for a year?
Well, I wouldn't say it's brewing. It's not like we hate each other.
Guys, we talked about this beforehand. You have to hate each other, or it's not.
We were told that it's blood, like at least eye gouging, grain punching, stuff like that. I mean, what's going on here?
I don't plan to do any. But so yeah, you know, and kind of he offered the opportunity to come on, and this is, you know, a great show. I watch it regularly. I might not agree with everything that's on the show, but I appreciate the job that you guys do in having those kinds of discussions. So that's why I'm here. That's why I do it.
Sweet.
Thank you for saying that. But you said you're from North Carolina too, right?
Yep. North Carolina.
So am I.
Are you really? What part?
I'm in Greensboro.
The borough. Nice.
The borough.
I'm down here in the gas house.
You're literally probably an hour and 15 away.
That
maybe
means
an hour if I'm driving. Yeah, you know, it's funny because I got there's somebody that watches the show that has a at his university there is a very firebrand street preacher. And so we're going down to meet up with that street preacher and have a little discussion out loud in the middle of the campus. So I'm looking forward to that. Maybe we could do the same. Maybe you and I could meet up and have a coffee and a discussion sometime.
Would love to.
That would be cool. Okay, so here's the way that this is going to work tonight. We're going to in the middle of the screen will be the timer. I'm not going to break in and throw them off their train of thought. So just guys, make sure that you keep an eye on that time. There'll be each person will have a 20-minute opener, followed by 2 7-minute rounds of rebuttals, and then a 15-minute discussion. After which, we will take any audience questions that we get in, super chats, that sort of thing. And then just remember that we will be having that after show following. Right after this, probably about 10 p.m., I would say, when we start that. Do you guys have any questions or anything like that that you want to get out of the way before we officially get it going?
I don't have any.
Okay. All right, then. Dave, if you will put a timer on. And we will be starting with Dean, because he is making the positive claim. And Dean, whenever you begin, your time will start.
All right. So real quick, thank you guys for the opportunity to come on and have this discussion with Nathaniel. Also like to thank Nathaniel for setting this up. This is actually my first ever debate in this type of setting. So I'll go ahead and get into the argument. Tonight I'm here to defend the resurrection of Jesus Christ. My goal tonight is to try and meet Nathaniel and the skeptics where they are and make the case for the resurrection. So I'm sure you've heard this before. My case isn't going to be relying on fulfilled prophecy, personal experience, the doctrine of inerrancy of the Bible, the doctrine of biblical infallibility, or miraculous testimony of other people. I'm really just going to defend two main points tonight. And the first point is any hypothesis, you know, surrounding the fate of Jesus has to account for the following things that scholars have a majority agreement on, maybe not a consensus, but a majority agreement on. First, Jesus died by crucifixion under Pontius Pilate between the years 30 and 33 CE. Number two, Jesus' body was buried in the tomb of Joseph Arimathea following his death, and approximately 3 days later was found empty. Number three, shortly after Jesus' death, his disciples had an experience in which they believed they saw the risen Jesus and went on to proclaim the bodily resurrection of Jesus. Number four, within a few years after Jesus' death, Paul converted to Christianity after experiencing what he interpreted as a post-resurrection appearance of Jesus. That all falls under the category of my first point. And then my second point is the best explanation of these facts is the hypothesis that God raised Jesus from the dead. So I want to go ahead and develop those 4 points under my main first point. And so fact one, that Jesus died by crucifixion. Steve and Kyle, get ready because here they come. Jesus died by crucifixion, documented in Josephus. There you go. Antiquity of the Jews. Also noted by Marbar Serapion, Lucian, Tacitus, and Annals 1544. He states that Jesus died the most extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of Pontius Pilate. They're also skeptical scholars, ones that you wouldn't classify as evangelicals, who also say that Jesus' death was the consequence of crucifixion, and it's indisputable, such as Gerd Ludemann, J.D. Crossan, Jesus Seminar, as debated Mike Lacona, said that the crucifixion is as sure as any historical event can ever be. John McIntyre, even though scholars who are critical have been moved to depart from almost everything else within the historical content of Christ's presence on earth, have found it impossible to think away the factuality of the death of Jesus Christ. Also, there are some early oral creeds in the text of the Bible regarding the crucifixion. Philippians 2:6-11, it says this. Now, this is only affirming that Jesus died. It says this, have the mindset among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself, becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So it talks about Jesus' death and his death on the cross. And so it seems here that Paul is quoting an early church creed regarding that belief around Jesus, and that comes from Bart Ehrman's blog. Fact number two, after his death, Jesus was buried in a tomb of Joseph Arimathea. Approximately 3 days later, his tomb was found empty by women followers. Number one, every gospel contains that narrative. Jesus' burial is implied in early creeds, such as 1 Corinthians 15 by Paul. The earliest Jewish polemics against the resurrection imply an empty tomb. There's no competing tradition with regards to that. Women visiting the tomb falls in line with traditional burial practices by Jews in the early first century. The story originates in Jerusalem. There's no veneration of the tomb of Jesus, which was a practice of the time. Jody Magnus, a non-Christian archaeologist who's an expert in the field of first, second temple burial practices, says that the gospel records are in line with the custom as the time. It also seems to be common knowledge via Acts chapter 2, 29 amongst Jesus' closest followers. Fact number three, shortly after the death of Jesus, the disciples had an experience that led them to believe that they had seen a bodily resurrection of Jesus. testimony of Paul, seen in 1 Corinthians 15:10. He's in agreement. After he cites this creed, he talks about himself and the earliest disciples in a plural form. But whether it was I or they, this is what we preach. So he's referencing that oral creed. Galatians 2:9. He notes that he had fellowship with the earliest disciples on the basis, of that testimony that they'd seen Jesus risen from the dead, on the basis of common belief, goal, and aim. Some other oral creeds, 1 Corinthians 15, we can get into that later as we do the cross-examination. I've only got 14 minutes left. And that creed dates to between 3 and 7 years of the death of Jesus. Also, we see a pre-Pauline Romans chapter, verses 3-4. It states, concerning the Son, who was descendant of David according to the flesh and was declared to be the Son of God in power according to the Spirit of holiness by his resurrection from the dead, Jesus our Lord. That is Rudolf Bultmann believes that's a pre-Pauline creed as well. Acts chapter 2, 32, one of the earliest records we have of the first sermon. Peter says that Jesus, this Jesus God raised up. Also talking about the death of David, how David, we still had his body. We don't have Jesus's body anymore. And then 1 Thessalonians 4:14 seems to be a pre-Pauline creed as well, according to Gene Green, where it talks about that they believe that Jesus died and rose again. Historian John Rogers states that this is the kind of stuff historians drool over. This claim is the earliest claim in Christianity regarding Jesus. Other views come much later. Then we have early church fathers. Irenaeus, Tertullian state that Clement of Rome was in fellowship with the apostles. Clement wrote a letter to the Corinthians, which states, therefore, having received orders complete certainty caused by the resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ and believed in the word of God, they went with the Holy Spirit's certainty, preaching the good news that the kingdom of God was about to come. Now, Paula Fredrickson, who's a part of the Hebrew University in Israel, states, and she's not a Christian, she states, I know in their own terms what they saw was the raised Jesus. That's what they say. And then all the historic evidence we have afterwards attests to their conviction that that's what they saw. I'm not saying that they really did see the raised Jesus. I wasn't there. I don't know what they saw, but I do know that as a historian, they must have seen something. Fact 4, within a few years after Jesus' death, Saul of Tarsus, a persecutor of the Christians, converted after experiencing what he described as a post-resurrection appearance. He notes that in 1 Corinthians 15:8. He also notes that in 1 Corinthians 9:1. Gary Habermas states that virtually every scholar grants that Paul had some type of experience in which he believed that he saw the risen Jesus. So the best explanation, I believe, for these facts is that the resurrection. It covers the explanatory scope, power. It's not ad hoc or contrived, and it's more plausible given the background information. Now, I think that if Nathaniel is going to carry the conversation tonight, he has to tear down that case and give something that's more plausible. And if he can't do that tonight, then the resurrection, the case for the resurrection, seems to carry the day. So that's my case. I've got 10, it says here, 10 minutes. And I can't see it because my screen's blocking it. And like 40 seconds. So I'll see that time if Nathaniel wants extra time.
There's actually a really good idea from the live chat. I think that we should do, since there's this extra time, and that is after you each get done like making your statement, have the other person sort of sum up what you said to make sure that they got your position correct, just in a really really quick way, just so that we're not arguing past each other, because sometimes that does happen. So Nathaniel, can you give us a brief summary of what Dean's position is?
Yeah, that was Habermas, Lacona, Mental Facts, and William Lane Craig. 100%.
Okay. Would that be appropriate, Dean? Minimal Facts?
Essentially, yeah.
Wilhelm Craig. Okay.
Yeah, all right. Wilhelm Craig.
So we will put 20 minutes back on the clock. And Nathaniel, whenever you begin, your time will start.
All right, thank you. I'm sorry if there's something in the background. My windows are so great in this apartment complex that you can hear the people outside that are blowing away the grass that grows so quickly down here in Dallas.
Lovely.
So Jesus was an incredibly important, and I would say the most important historical figure. Both of the world's largest religions, with a combined following of 4.2 billion people, 57% of the population, exist solely because of Jesus of Nazareth. This cannot be denied. The incredible stories of his birth, life, death, and resurrection have reached every country on the planet. One cannot say these stories of Jesus are not incredible, but should we accept them as historical? The most important part of the life of Jesus, and the only reason Christianity can exist, has to do with his supposed resurrection. I'm not here to debate the existence of Jesus, and have granted, for the sake of this discussion, that which Josephus writes in Jewish Antiquities. About this time, there lived Jesus, a wise man, for he was one who performed surprising deeds and was a teacher of such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. And when upon the accusation of the principal men among us, Pilate had condemned him to a cross, those who had first come to love him did not cease, and the tribe of the Christians, so called after him, still has not disappeared. In fact, the part of the Easter story that I care least about is the death of Jesus. As far as I can tell, every person dies. It's the coming back to life part that I question. The Apostle Paul is correct when he says in 1 Corinthians 15:12 to 14, but if it is preached that Christ has been raised from the dead, how can some of you say there is no resurrection of the dead? If there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is worthless, and so is your faith. Because this is the case, we must critically examine the most important story about the most important figure in the history of the world. Researching antiquity is an incredibly difficult task. Oftentimes, there exists little, if any, evidence of certain events, people, places. There is much which has been forever lost to history. How, then, can we come to any conclusions? Well, New Testament scholar Kirsop Lake provides a path when at the turn of the 20th century, he said, the first task of the historical inquirer is to collect the pieces of evidence. The second is to discuss the trustworthiness and meaning of each separate piece, and the third is to reconstruct the events to which the evidence relates. Using this method, as well as the four-point approach utilized by Bart Ehrman and many other current historians, one should have an open mind and accept where the evidence leads. It is my hope we do this not only tonight, but in every part of our lives. Now, to start, I'd like to say this. The Bible is not evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. It is the claim. Whether one believes Jesus came back to life because of the Bible is irrelevant. This does not mean we should throw out the Bible. Not at all. In fact, we should look into the claims in the Bible and determine, based on historical events and extra-biblical accounts, contemporary extra-biblical accounts, if the claims are true. I'll be spending a bit of my time discussing the reliability of the Gospels and if we should accept them. But other pieces, like my rejection of Habermas's and Lacona's minimal facts approach, my rejection of the criterion of embarrassment when it comes to women finding the tomb, my rejection of C.S. Lewis's so-called trilemma, etc., will not be mentioned in this opening statement. I'm happy to speak about them, partially because Dean brought them up in later on in tonight's conversation. It's important for us to consider each claim on its own. While a series of claims with evidence can build a case, they each bear their own burden of proof. And as it is said, the more extraordinary the claim, the more extraordinary is the evidence required. The case of a man coming back from the dead is rather extraordinary. In A New History of Early Christianity, famed Greek and Roman historian Charles Freeman says, the sources which describe the physical resurrection of Jesus are, for instance, so late, fragmentary, and contradictory that the question of whether it happened must be left open.
Jewish historian Alan Siegel says, surely no one would seriously argue that the early Christians did not believe that Christ had been raised. But just as surely few, if any, modern historians would argue that any evidence could move us from this historical fact to the supposition that Jesus was actually and physically raised from the dead and that he appeared in his transformed fleshly body. It is therefore important, in my opinion, to stay within the realm of historians and stay away from the ideas that theologians, who have a preconceived bias of their own firmly held religious beliefs, can provide. So what do we do? Well, to start, we look at Jesus. Jesus never wrote any account of his life, ministry, or teaching. Most of his followers were illiterate, and no document written about Jesus is by an eyewitness or a contemporary. While Jesus and his followers would have spoken Aramaic, there remain just 26 Aramaic words attributed to Jesus. Every other word is in Greek. It is said there are about 5,600 surviving copies of the Greek New Testament, showing 99.5% accuracy between them. Okay. There are 643 copies of the Iliad, showing 95% accuracy between them, and that was written about a century before the New Testament. Does that mean the Iliad is true because it has a lot of copies that are really old and agree with each other? Now, it's also important to note there are zero surviving New Testament manuscripts from the first century and just 8 from the second century, with more than 1,000 written, should say copied, in the 12th century. And as was mentioned, I recommend the Vice Rhino recent video on this. A manuscript can mean a small scrap of papyrus. When considering the Gospels, which are the accounts every story of Jesus is taken from, we are expected to accept the anonymous authors writing decades after the death of Jesus remembered each detail, not only of the life of Jesus, but also of events of which no eyewitness was there to see. Should these memories and then oral retellings be considered reliable? An account is given by Philip Ziegler in Our Longest Days, A People's History of the Second World War, in which diaries kept by British observers were compared to their recollections 30 years later. His findings? Any relationship between the incident they had described in the diary and the story they told in 1975 was entirely coincidental. They got everything wrong: the date, places, and the sequence of events. Now, this is incredibly common. Memory researchers from a bevy of universities surveyed more than 3,000 people in New York City, Washington, D.C., Boston, and 4 other cities in Connecticut, Missouri, and California regarding what they called a flashbulb memory of the terrorist attacks on September 11th. The surveys were completed at 1 week, 1 year, 3 years, and 10 years after the attacks. According to lead investigator Elizabeth A. Phelps, from that first survey to the second survey a year later, the overall consistency of the details of how they learned of 9/11 was only 63%. At the third survey, 3 years after the attack, consistency was 57%, so people were only a little more than 57% right for a lot of the details. We can take the obvious from those two examples. Our minds do not retain information the way we think it does. Now, surely the followers of Jesus had emotional responses to his death and would think themselves confident in their accurate retelling of his life, death, and subsequent events. What we find, though, is their emotional responses would likely have had a negative effect on their memories. When one can state with a high degree of certainty that the accounts written decades and likely lifetimes, only 4 in 100 men during that time lived to be 50, after the death of Jesus, they contained a multitude of errors from the memories of those who first told the stories. This does not include later embellishment and outright legendary additions, which should give us even more pause about the historical veracity of the Gospels. Now, what happened to the disciples? It has been said and is taken for granted that the disciples of Jesus believed and spoke their story until martyrdom, in which they could have recanted and possibly saved their lives. It is stated, surely nobody would die for something they knew to be a lie. But should we also take this for granted? First, how many disciples claim to have even seen Jesus alive after his death? The answer may surprise some in that it is zero. None of the disciples wrote and said they personally saw post-resurrection Jesus. The only person in the New Testament who does say he saw Jesus was Paul. But that's not the full story.
Paul had an experience in which he heard Jesus speaking. He did not actually see him. Neither do his two unarmed companions who never spoke or wrote about the supposed event. Paul also never spoke of an empty tomb or the women who the Gospels say discovered it empty. In his writings in 1 Corinthians, Paul also speaks of only a spiritual resurrection instead of the physical appearances of Jesus mentioned in the Gospels. The claims of the deaths of the disciples have commonly been known as tradition, which is a fancy word for we passed it down through church. There are no extra biblical sources that state the disciples died defending their faiths. And I'm happy to go into this regarding the actual outside epistles in the conversation. Are the biblical accounts reliable between themselves? Let me just go with Bart Ehrman here and say it depends on which gospel you read and move on from there. One remark that I hear from apologists is we should have information from opponents of Christianity. They then point to Matthew and the supposed meeting of the Sanhedrin to make up the story of stealing the body. This is, of course, inside the resurrection narrative and doesn't fit the criteria. There were opponents of early Christianity, though, and on the doctrine, on the true doctrine, apologies, third century philosopher Celsus wrote, among other things, it is clear to me that the writings of the Christians are a lie, and that your fables are not well enough constructed to conceal this monstrous fiction. I have heard that some of your interpreters are on to the inconsistencies, and pen in hand, alter the original writings 3, 4, and several more times over in order to be able to deny the contradictions in the face of criticism. This is a person writing this not 200 years after the death of Jesus, making such damning claims. I mentioned, obviously, the appearance of Paul, or the appearance to Paul. This is written in 1 Corinthians 15, 1-11, referenced in 1 Corinthians 9, Galatians 1, and Philippians 3, 8. Paul does not differentiate his experience from any others, including Peter and James. He uses the Greek verb upthi, which specifically means appeared, and this can be seen and understood by Paul's use of the term of the name Christ instead of the previous title of the Christ. And this can show that Paul saw the risen Christ and his glory the same way John would experience Jesus in Revelation 1:10. This means, of course, that it was not bodily. And it would not have been unlike the Old Testament visions in Job, Isaiah, Daniel, Ezekiel, and Amos, or the Jewish visions in 1 Enoch and 4 Ezra, in which each appearance was not bodily, but rather spiritual. Paul never makes the case that Jesus rose bodily from the dead, but rather that our earthly bodies are incapable of entering heaven. Visions of the supernatural are not uncommon and are certainly not unique to antiquity. Susan Atkins, convicted and imprisoned for life for her part in the Charles Manson cult, converted to Christianity in 1974 after claiming her cell door had opened and, quote, a brilliant light poured over her. She saw this as Jesus coming to let her know she was forgiven for her sins. Many others have had visions of the Virgin Mary, most notably 14-year-old Bernadette Soubirous in Lourdes, France, who said she saw Virgin Mary in 1858, but then later said that she felt pressured by the Catholic Church in the area, which said that they have recognized more than 65 instances of, quote, miraculous healing, and none of which, I imagine, came from Benny Hinn at that time. I cannot confirm since then. But Bernadette's story is one of many. Visions of the supernatural are common, especially when we are told a particular account or set of events that leads to the demise of a famous person or character. At the LaLaurie Mansion in New Orleans, people claim to hear the screams of slaves who were mutilated and burned. People claim to see the ghosts of former inmates walking through Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia. Ghosts are on the RMS Queen Mary, the Lizzie Borden Bed and Breakfast in Fall River, Massachusetts, even the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, Colorado. And that's just the beginning. We also see images and or faces in clouds, on toast, or most recently, in the fire of the Notre Dame Cathedral. These types of pareidolia happen in the frontal cortex of our pattern-seeking brains. It doesn't mean they are real, and it certainly doesn't mean God or Jesus is judging the Catholic Church for tourism. And a quick side note on that. Tourism? That was the route the Catholic Doors Twitter took to take on that one. Like, of all the atrocities committed by the Catholic Church, you went with tourism. No mention of sexual abuse, which does happen. God is going to burn down the Notre Dame. Think of a better excuse. We also have dreams that we think about. When I am involved in theatrical productions, I oftentimes find myself dreaming about the production, those involved in it, and how the production will go. And oftentimes these dreams are the scariest because they seem to be so real. I also have PTSD. My dreams are full of visions and memories, some of which are real and seem to have happened yesterday. Every so often, I wake up not knowing where I am, terrified of something I see in the dark. It is not real, but I sometimes am so terrified that I turn on the lights before I'm even aware that I have done so. I take medicine now to help me with this, medicine that would not have been available to those in antiquity. We also hallucinate when we face exhaustion or severe dehydration. This doesn't mean that the people we're seeing aren't real, but our interactions certainly aren't. And I have Paul Enns to thank for turning me on to the bereavement hallucinations, in which people who have, and this is in a 2018 study, people who have and stay with a partner for an extended period of time and are within 4 years post-loss, but as it becomes, as it's closer to the loss of a loved one, they experience bereavement hallucinations. In my opinion, it's safe to say the disciples, especially Peter and James, who are the only two mentioned by Paul as to have seen Jesus alive, were fairly close to Jesus and suffered an incredible amount of psychological distress after his death. This can certainly be said of James, who, according to some texts, was the biological brother of Jesus. This also brings the point of how the disciples viewed Jesus. In the months and years following the supposed resurrection, those who preached he had been risen would have spoken of him by name other than Son of God, Messiah, Son of Man, Lord, or Prophet. None of these Jewish phrases, and they are Jewish, imply divinity. To the Jews, the Messiah was one who would come to liberate and throw off the chains of oppression, especially at that time of Rome, usually by insurrection and violent uprising. We can see this through their adoration of the Maccabees. If we put ourselves in the sandals of the disciples, just watch the tragic event from the person that was their leader that they spent their entire, the last few years of their life with every single day. They turned around and they practically ran back to Galilee because they would be scared that they would also be arrested and possibly executed. 140 kilometers of a desert wasteland, received less than 2 inches of rain from April to October. They hadn't slept. Prior to the 30 hours, usually takes 30 hours to get there. They would not have slept in over 2 days. Exhaustion was setting in. I know how this goes, and so does Dean, especially when we're up for hours and hours going in the military and in the boot camp. They then locked themselves in a room and hid, exhausted, still fearful of imminent death. Think about this and consider the other situations. This is the perfect time for one or even numerous visions, dreams, hallucinations. More than one likely suffered from early onset PTSD, and we have seen how that can damage even what would be considered the strongest of psyches. I'm not saying that this did happen. I, in fact, don't believe that the disciples actually saw a risen Jesus. But when we are faced with the choice between stress, was it these men had hallucinations brought on by aforementioned stresses, as I mentioned, and believed they saw it? Or should we say the supernatural? Historians, when faced with a lack of evidence, and there is a lack of evidence, extra-biblically especially, must accept the fact which is most likely natural over that which is supernatural. How much time? I have a minute, 30, okay. There are over 280 million people subscribe to Pentecostalism in some denomination. They speak in tongues, roll around on the ground, believe that they can interpret these tongues, think they see visions, can interpret dreams. This is no different than what Paul would have gone through. What Paul, who I would agree with Richard Carrier, was a schizotypal. Belief in special powers. He would have unusual perceptions and see illusions. These people would accept that, and we see it today. Almost the entire population of 280 million people, which is almost the entire population of the United States of America, does the same thing today. Why is it such a difficult thing to imagine that the same would have happened in the early church? We must consider there are no extra-biblical accounts of Jesus. There are of Jesus performing anything supernatural. The idea that the disciples died for their faith is traditional, which is an oral history. We have no reason to accept people come back from the dead, ever, whether it be in the Bible or any other religious text, or as far as I know since then. And I don't see a reason, and Dean, you're a great guy, but I don't see a way that the minimal facts, which I don't consider the minimal facts at all, or to meet even any kind of burden of proof, should convince anybody. Thanks.
Right on the money.
Nice.
Right on the money. Okay, Dave, you'll put 7 minutes up on the clock, and we will begin with Dean and your first rebuttal.
Okay, so in my opening statement, I said that there are four essential or four facts that scholars, majority of scholars, agree on, and that those four facts were that Jesus died by crucifixion. Shortly after that, his disciples experienced what they believed to be the risen Jesus, and they proclaimed a bodily resurrection of Jesus. Three, Jesus' body was buried in the tomb of Joseph Arimathea. Following his death, approximately 3 days later, it was found empty. Four, within a few years of Jesus' death, Paul converted to Christianity after experiencing what he interpreted as a post-resurrection appearance of Jesus. Now, in Nathaniel's response to that, essentially what Nathaniel's case was, the core case, was that you can't believe the Gospels because they're late, they're fragmentary, they're contradictory. That Jesus never wrote any account of his own life, that these Gospels were anonymous. He mentioned things like the disciples hallucinated, as well that Paul preached a spiritual resurrection. So notice in his case that he made, that he mentioned something that I completely and totally ceded, essentially, in my opening statement. My case is not built on the infallibility of the New Testament, but he stuck with that idea that they're contradictory, that they're fragmented, and that they are late. Now, my case is simply based on 1 Corinthians 15, that we have good evidence that the resurrection took place, regardless of whether or not there are contradictions in the Gospels, regardless of whether or not the Gospels are anonymous, regardless of whether or not the Gospels could be potentially late. So this is something that two points that I want to, you know, address initially off of Nathaniel's opening statement is, number one, just because there might be, and I don't think there are, I think there are differences, I don't think there are contradictions, but let's say that there are contradictions in the Gospel. Does that automatically mean that the text isn't historically accurate? So, for instance, when we look at Caesar's assassination written by Plutarch, right? It says that conspirators gathered around him for petitions. Caesar did not cry out, you know, being stabbed. Caesar grabbed Casca's knife and cursed him. Caesar didn't leap to his feet. Only some senators took part in it. Brutus stabbed him in the groin and he cried out before he was being stabbed. Caesar cried out when that happened and he hit his face. But Suetonius records a completely different account of Caesar's assassination. He says, the conspirators gathered around him to pay respect. Caesar did not cry out before being stabbed. Caesar's assassination. Caesar grabbed Casca's arm and stabbed him with a stylus, right? Caesar did leap to his feet. It doesn't say that there were any senators who didn't take part in it. And it doesn't say where Caesar was stabbed. And it also, Suetonius' account, doesn't say that Caesar hit his face. So would Nathaniel grant that because there are contradictions in the assassination of Caesar, that that event didn't take place? That's a question that I'd like to ask him. Also, what about the fires in Rome, Nero's fire? Tacitus says, where was Nero? Tacitus says that he was miles away. Cassico says that he was in his palace. And Suetonius says that he was fiddling on a tower. Where was he? Was Rome even burned? Because of those contradictory facts, or seeming contradictory facts in those account of Rome, of the Roman fire, does Nathaniel grant that that didn't happen because, or it's not historical because of the contradiction instances there? As far as Jesus not, you know, writing an account of his life, my question is, what does that have to do with whether or not Jesus was raised from the dead? That doesn't seem to have any bearing on the historical claim that I'm making about the body of Jesus. Regardless of whether you think Jesus wrote something or not, that has no bearing on whether or not the resurrection of Jesus is true. Also, what else? About he mentioned hallucinations with regards to the disciples. This is something that is probably the most popular objection to the resurrection. And what we know about hallucinations is hallucinations don't last for periods of hours. They're brief. Nathaniel's correct when they are similar to dreams, but you can't share dreams. You can't share hallucinations. I couldn't dream, that the Duke Blue Devils won the national championship this year. I couldn't dream that they won the national championship, wake up and look over at my wife and say, I mean, that was an amazing dream that we had. Could we share that tomorrow? So hallucinations don't happen in groups, but what we see in the gospel records, not because they're divinely inspired, just because they're accounts. What we see in the gospel records is that Jesus appears to these disciples seemingly for more than just a couple of minutes, for more than just a couple of seconds. He's by the shore. He's walking. He's talking. He's having conversation. He's actually cooking fish in the Gospel of John, which is very interesting. So all of those things drive against the hallucination theory. Also, they don't explain. It doesn't explain the empty tomb. It doesn't explain the conversion of Paul. And it's a poor candidate to explain the group appearances of the disciples in the 500, because hallucinations like dreams don't happen. So I don't have enough time to get to the bodily resurrection, so we'll get to that in my second rebuttal.
Okay, and we'll reset the clock. And Nathaniel, whenever you start, your time will begin.
All right. So about the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. So Joseph of Arimathea, he doesn't exist outside of the Bible. That's actually outside of one thing that happens in the four Gospels. And therefore, I have no reason to think that he ever actually even existed, which is another reason, and you'll notice that I mentioned it earlier, that Paul didn't say anything about the empty tomb at all. The only place the empty tomb is mentioned is in the four Gospels. But if Paul didn't mention it, how important could the empty tomb actually have been? In fact, Paul, even in the Apostles' Creed in 1 Corinthians 15, he specifically, all that he says is that Jesus died, was buried, and came back to life. Says nothing about an empty tomb. And Joseph of Arimathea, there's no mention of him anywhere else in history, except for, and if you are a fan of legend, when he showed up in England with the Holy Grail. I don't accept that, because it wasn't mentioned in Monty Python, so not real. You have good reason to say that the resurrection took place out of 1 Corinthians 15. Well, that's not a good reason. As I mentioned earlier, the Bible is the claim, not the evidence. You can be convinced by claims, sure, but evidence should lead you to support the fact that what you're accepting is actually reasonable to accept. Contradictions in the Gospels. Yeah, there's a lot of them. And does that automatically mean the text is not historically accurate? This is the part of the reason that I brought up the fact that Jesus didn't actually write anything of himself. We're looking, when I do this, I'm actually looking at historical accounts. And
If Jesus would have written something himself, it would have lent more credibility to anything of him being like the Son of God or something of that nature, or somebody that would have actually, instead of being something written 50, 60, 70, 80 years after, by anonymous sources after he died, would have been something that would have added historical veracity. Now, does that automatically mean that the text is not historically accurate? No, it does not. But, Dean, I should ask you this. Why should I accept it as true if it's contradictory? And it is incredibly contradictory. That's why I skipped over it earlier and made the joke, it depends which gospel you read, because there are so many contradictions. And I mentioned how many New Testament historians earlier who actually will tell you that that's the case. They're scholars. I actually have heard you say before, Dean, that you think there's as much evidence for Jesus' resurrection as there is for Caesar crossing the Rubicon. And I would like you to substantiate that because I don't believe you. Now, you brought the death of Caesar and the other claims and Nero fire, not to, you know, that kind of thing. I'm a fan of people that like try to do that, because Caesar dying by either having his throat slit and being stabbed by Brutus, and then hiding his head underneath one of the togas so that you couldn't see him in his death throes, or dying by some other way, is unimportant just because of the fact that he died. And you might say, wait a second, but hold on, let me just finish this. The Nero fire, where that's actually the reason that written, I think, in First Clement, the reason that one of the disciples was martyred was because, you know, that Nero wanted to blame the Christians for some stuff, and so he started the fire. Was Nero even around? The difference between these things is that neither Caesar nor Nero claimed to come back from the dead. See, that's the big difference. People start fires and blame other people for their arson, or are not around and are blamed for it all the time. People die all the time in the way that, and sometimes, you know, your best friend stabs you in the back, like Caesar. But that's not the same thing as somebody, a false equivalency when somebody, it's not the same thing as somebody coming back from the dead. The hallucinations, and by the way, the empty tomb is not mentioned. I haven't mentioned that anywhere else. The hallucinations thing, I'm a fan. You keep coming back to that because it's actually, I have 2 minutes and 30 seconds. Dr. Phelps, Elizabeth Phelps, you remember her from earlier. She said, emotion kind of focuses you on a few details, but lets you ignore other details. And if you are highly aroused by fear, not the kind of arousal Steve's thinking of, that emotion helps you store things in your memory better in your storage process called consolidation. And that depends on the interaction of the amygdala and hippocampus. But what we've known for a while is that emotion gives you a stronger confidence in your memory than it does necessarily on the accuracy. Usually when a memory has highly vivid details and you're confident in those details, that means you're likely to be right. Confidence almost often goes hand in hand with accuracy. But when something is highly emotional, they often get separated. And these kind of manic hallucinations happen. They have hysterical hallucinations that happen. We see things that they happen. An anecdote in the last minute that I have earlier, I mentioned this to somebody earlier, somebody very close to me, her father had died, and she would continue to have dreams about her father. And by the way, I want to put a link in the chat here for you, Dean, that you can read that sometimes hallucinations can last between 12 and 18 months. And she used to have dreams about her father all the time, in which they were so real, and she'd wake up crying and she thought he was alive. A friend of mine, his cat died, and a cat that he loved that he had all the time. And he would go back home and would regularly see his cat jump up out of the corner of his eye up on like the hearth above the fireplace. It wasn't real, but he would see it. These are things that we get all of the time, and we can actually see this with the things that matter the most to us. And there are plenty of examples of this in recorded, not just medical history, but recent recorded medical inquiries and stuff like this. There's no reason to doubt anything that I have said, while at the same time, there's no reason to accept anything that the disciples said. In fact, we don't even know how many of the disciples were actually real people. And I think I'm good with that.
Okay. And we will move now to the last of the 7-minute rebuttals between the two of you. And Dean, whenever you're ready.
All right. So Nathaniel said that the difference between what I cited with regards to the contradictions in Caesar's assassination and Nero is the difference between something that takes place regularly and something that takes place supernaturally. And my point is simply that essentially history is history, and the historical method that you would apply to something like Caesar's assassination and something like you would try and apply, okay, well, is this event historical? Seems like you would keep that the same. You know, when we do a cross dialogue, I'd like to get more information about that. As far as Joseph of Arimathea, it seems to me that on the basis of the criterion of embarrassment, that Joseph of Arimathea seems to be real on that basis, because there's no reason why the gospel writers would make a hero out of a member of the Sanhedrin. They have every reason to paint him as a bad guy. And if I'll give you the synoptics as one source, and I'll give you the Gospel of John as another, that's two documents in antiquity that note that. As far as 1 Corinthians, as far as 1 Corinthians 15, Nathaniel seems to be thinking that I'm using the Bible. 1 Corinthians 15, and that's a mistake. I'm not saying that because this is a divine document, therefore it's true. I'm simply saying that we have a early oral church creed that dates between 3 and 7 years after the supposed event, and that's super close to the event of Jesus. Now, Nathaniel hasn't given any reason. He's talked about hallucinations, and he's talked about cats jumping up and, you know, this, that, and the other. And I'd love to see the citation that talks about hallucinations lasting for 12 to 18 months, because Gary Sibsey suggests that there is no evidence for that. Or has Nathaniel really given a reason why how hallucinations could account for the 500 that are mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15? So I'm interested, in that as well. Now, one thing I would like to go back to as far as the anonymous documents that are talked about. Yeah, we handled Jesus. He didn't write anything. But hey, Socrates didn't write anything either. The only reason that we know of Socrates is because of his student Plato. So why couldn't it be the case, even if the Gospels are anonymous, why couldn't it be the case that we know about Jesus because of these anonymous sources that are written, you know, relatively, I'll even give you the late part of the first century. Why isn't that, plausible? Also, Plutarch and Livy in their writings, in Plutarch's lives and some 50 biographies that he writes, his name's not, he doesn't attach his name to that, but nobody throws out that Plutarch isn't the author of those documents simply because they're anonymous. Same thing with Livy as well. So those don't seem to compute to support Nathaniel's case that anonymity of a document doesn't mean that you can't accurately assign who wrote those documents as well. Secondly, he hasn't really said anything. He said that, you know, Paul was a schizophrenic, and so he's psychoanalyzing somebody from, 2,000 years ago, which most historians would say is almost nearly, impossible. I'd like to know, how he gets to Paul being a schizophrenic. But also the explanatory scope of what he's talking about with regards to the hallucination theory. Even if you accounted for Paul as having a hallucination, as he stated before, there are about 50% of people will have you know, some type of hallucination. And so even by that number, for Nathaniel's theory to hold true, he would need 100% of the disciples to have a hallucination. And in some cases, he would need 100% of the disciples to have the same hallucination at the same time. And that just seems that theory just seems a little not a little. It's ad hoc, and it seems to be contrived as well. I'm glad to hear that Nathaniel, for the case of this conversation, has granted me the crucifixion. So he thinks that Jesus definitely died, and essentially, I think he would say that in some form or fashion that he was. That he was buried. So with that, I'll just go ahead and wrap up with that, and I'll cede the rest of the time to Nathaniel.
Okay. And the last one in the rebuttal rounds, Nathaniel, whenever you're ready.
Dean, I put a link in the chat just for you, buddy, so you can see. That comes out of the UK, and they have just as good science as I think that the United States does. Better healthcare. Again, one is an extraordinary claim. The other is not. It's not an extraordinary claim when Caesar gets stabbed or has his throat slit. It's not an extraordinary claim. That's the reason that Jesus' supposed resurrection is different. And I saying a person drove a car and saying a person's car flew, one of those two requires, I could be lying about both of them or telling the truth about both of them. One of them would require more extraordinary evidence. And that's why there is, the two are not comparative. This is the same thing as saying, did Muhammad ride, you know, a horse or whatever up to heaven when he died, or Elijah or Elisha, right? And that actually comes to the transfiguration in the Bible. Can I actually take the claim of the transfiguration in Mark chapter 9 seriously when he takes, what is it, Peter and James and John, I think, up onto the mountain, and then they see Moses and Elijah, and like they're talking to him like Luke and Jedi or something, and Jesus is, you know, he got his clothes all cleaned or whatever, and I'm supposed to be able to take this as historical fact. This is an extraordinary claim. It's not the same thing as saying Jesus, or not Jesus, but Caesar, who was a real person, died at one point. Whether the stories about Caesar's death, who again never claimed to be anything supernatural, are in part legendary, and in fact, you using that part of that type of a claim actually lends more credence my way, because the Bible, as we go through Mark and Matthew and Luke and John, becomes more and more and more legendary until in the book of John, Jesus is a superhero who comes out, bitch slaps Judas Iscariot, and says, "Yo, who the fuck you looking for? Right? I'm Jesus. Let's go do this thing." He's putting ears back on people and everything. Right? That's a legend that requires extraordinary claims or extraordinary evidence. It becomes more legendary as you get into the Epistle of Peter, the lost gospel, or not the Epistle, but the Gospel of Peter. The lost gospel of Judas Iscariot, my personal favorite, the Gospel of Thomas. It becomes even more and more legendary. Everything about it does. The extraordinary evidence continues to build. So one of them is an extraordinary claim. The other is he may not have died the way with the knife in the back or the throat slit. I reject the criterion of embarrassment when it comes to this wholeheartedly. Especially when it comes to Joseph of Arimathea. My claim was that Joseph of Arimathea is only mentioned in the Bible and nowhere else in history. I have no reason to accept that, not only in the Bible, but only in one particular instance, I have no reason to accept that he ever existed. And again, the Gospels are the claim, not the evidence. You can't point to the Gospel and to the Gospel of John and say Jesus existed and then say that's how I know Jesus existed. We think that it is an oral creed. Paul is simply reciting what he was told by others. That is it. 500, that's a claim in the Bible. It's nowhere else. Nowhere is it written anywhere. Just like it's not written anywhere that an earthquake happened around 29, or 30 or 33 or whichever, whenever Jesus died at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I get the eclipse thing. In fact, in 29 AD, there was actually an eclipse. There's also one in 78 CE, which I called AD a second ago, apologies, where that actually kind of would make sense because it happened and the totality was, you know, it was in the middle of the afternoon type of thing. I could see that happening. So there is actually a natural thing I could go with that. But earthquakes, zombies walking around. No, these are claims in the Bible and nothing that I should take literally. The Gospels are the reason we know that Jesus existed. And kind of. Paul actually wrote his stuff first. So the Gospels are actually kind of secondary. I never said Paul is a schizophrenic. Based on the criterion, I would have said that Paul, because he saw visions and hallucinations, regularly saw them, was a schizotypal. There's a difference there. And none of the disciples said that they personally saw Jesus. None of them. Not a single disciple said, I saw Jesus alive after he was dead. There are people who speak in the third person in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I say they're anonymous, by the way, because they have names attached to them like that. And again, the reason that it's important to note they're anonymous because the people that wrote them were not the people who were eyewitnesses to Jesus. That's important, especially when we go back and we look at how people forget things and how people misplace things, even flashbulb instances. I mention hallucinations only because it's something that happens. You wouldn't actually need to have all 12 of the disciples have hallucinations at the same time because none of them said they had one. There's not a single one. In fact, I do enjoy that, this is simply something that I considered earlier today or yesterday. And Peter would have been somebody who was illiterate and who was a fisherman and who maybe when Jesus died figured out, and he was a leader of the disciples. Maybe when Jesus died, figured out, I don't want to go back to being a fisherman. I kind of like what I'm doing right now. And then made this up that he saw Jesus. And then told the others. And why would they not believe him? This is a person who, if the story is correct, that they had seen and been around when he walked up and he said, I saw Jedi hanging out up there. And they would have believed him because Jesus would be with him when they were alone. With James, which in some text is mentioned the brother of Jesus, this is the same thing with the people in Joseph Smith's life, who even when they left the church would not recant against Joseph Smith. This is parts of his family, not wanting to ruin a family name. They both had reasons as to why they, by name, mentioned by name by Paul, would continue with the story. Everything else, again, this is simply oral retellings that come specifically from the Bible. The fact that somebody existed historically means nothing when it comes to the extraordinary claims of which we have no extraordinary evidence at all. Thank you.
Good on that. Okay. All right. So Dave, if you'll put 15 minutes on, now you can go at each other.
Who wants to go? You want to go first, Nathaniel? I got the first word in the opening statement. You can get the first couple of questions and in the discussion.
Let me see. So you accept that Joseph of Arimathea was a real person?
Yeah, on the basis of the criterion of embarrassment, I do.
Only the, even though he's only mentioned in one part of a couple of the Gospels.
Okay, so do we reject? Do we automatically reject?
Well, this matters.
Person as a person of history, just because they're only mentioned once in one particular area, I don't think so. We have at least two sources. For Joseph of Arimathea, the Synoptics and the Gospel of John.
Yeah, those are places that make the claim. Yes, there's no evidence. The reason this matters is because supposedly Joseph of Arimathea provided the tomb for the body of Jesus. Again, the tomb that was never mentioned by Paul, who had the earliest writings.
Right. In a creed. And what we know about oral creeds is that oral creeds aren't narratives. They're designed to give the gist of the account so that people remember them.
Which specifically says it was buried.
Yeah, sure. So would you say that based upon Paul's creed in 1 Corinthians 15 that Jesus was buried? But that's the claim that Jesus was buried.
I would accept that over something that was written later on. Sure, that was closer to the time Paul became a Christian and who went on what, 3 different missionary journeys before he even met the 12 or 11, and then Judas, depending on how you think his life ended.
Well, no, in Galatians
isn't that what he believed though? Isn't, because he only got his, and he specifically said this, I received mine from a vision, not from men. So is that not what he believed? He didn't actually get anything else from Peter or James.
No, so what takes place in Galatians chapter 1 is that Paul says that he received a revelation from Jesus, and then 3 years later he went up to Jerusalem, and in Acts it talks about how he went up there to basically, I think it's either in Acts or Galatians where he says, I went up there to make sure we were preaching the same gospel. In Acts it definitely says that he received the right hand of fellowship from the apostles.
This was after he had... I lost Dean. I can't hear Dean.
I'm here.
Oh, okay, sorry. This was after he had gone on his journey. He had gone and visited more than one city after at that point. I think I actually have Saint Saul right here. I think I can actually look at that. But yeah, he had already, before he went and met Peter, he had already gone on, they'd already been like a schism in the church.
I don't deny that he went on missionary journeys before he met the disciples. I'm simply saying that Paul believed that Jesus was buried. And what I'm struggling to understand, I guess, is why would you accept that Jesus was buried, but not accept that he was buried in a tomb?
That doesn't actually. Sorry, I am actually. Like Paul doesn't mention anything like that, and Paul has the earliest accounts.
Okay, so then you would accept that since Paul was earlier than the Gospels, that he is an early source for the Jesus narrative, for the historicity of Jesus in those accounts. He's a better source than the Gospels.
Oh, absolutely. Paul is the best source, which is also the reason that we would say that Jesus was not raised bodily. Because Paul not only doesn't ever speak for that, but also speaks in rejection of that. Using the same Greek wording.
Before we shift to the bodily thing, I've got a question. So you do accept that in 1 Corinthians 15, with the burial of Jesus, that Paul, even though he doesn't mention Joseph of Arimathea, says that believed that Jesus was buried. Now my question is, do you accept the other things in that early oral creed that are mentioned about Jesus?
Let's be honest, to be very frank, I don't accept the Bible as historical at all. When it comes to supernatural things, that's important. That way nobody can think that. Paul did mention that somebody had told him, that they appeared first to Peter and then to the 12 and then to 500 and also to James and last of all to me. Yes, he did say that. But he specifically, the reason I say buried is very specific because it goes against and the way that his vision that he got, and you can get this at a couple of different times, but his vision was not bodily, and that is directly contradictory to the claims made in the gospel, as well as the empty tomb narrative, which is in the synoptics, and then my favorite book of John. And it is my favorite. I wish we could just focus on that one, but Mark is apparently the earliest one. I guess we could go and talk about Peter, but that's totally up to you.
Even if I see to you that the Joseph of Arimathea narrative is not historical, we could still make the case that Jesus was buried in some fashion, based upon 1 Corinthians 15 and Philippians, well, not Philippians chapter 2, but 1 Corinthians 15.
Sure, it was the day before the Passover. He got taken down, thrown into a shallow grave with a bunch of other people. Sure, why not?
Okay. Well, you know, we can get into that another time. I got a question. I have a question for you. So you've said a couple of times, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. My first question is, why isn't extraordinary? Well, let me ask it this way. Would you consider any type of event in which the odds of that event taking place, would you consider something in which the odds of that event of taking place 1 in 300 million, would you consider that to be an extraordinary claim or extraordinary event, that if something took place and the odds of that taking place were 1 in 300 million, that would be an extraordinary event?
Depends on 300 million. We could say that one could happen. It would seem like it's a high event, but if we say something's going to happen to 1 in 300 million people, that'd be extraordinary, sure. Then we have to consider there's more than 7 billion people on the planet, and then that becomes less extraordinary, but sure, 1 in 300 million.
So 1 in 300 million. If I just gave you the resurrection. So my point is, so for instance, and this is what I'm getting at. So for instance, the odds of winning the lottery are 1 in 300 million. Would you say that somebody winning the lottery is an extraordinary event?
Oh, you did not watch the Dillahunty Winger debate, did you?
I don't care about the Dillahunty Winger debate. I'm just asking, do you think that that's an extraordinary claim? That if I said, hey, I won the lottery, would that be an extraordinary claim based on the odds of that possibly happening? Would you say that's an extraordinary claim?
Sure. But I could prove it, right? If I had the evidence, I could show you the evidence, right?
Yeah.
Not even the ticket, but actually the money.
Yeah. My point is twofold. Number one, that you could build the case for an extraordinary event taking place based upon a cumulative number of smaller events or evidences, number one. So the claim that I won the lottery, extraordinary claim, could be backed up by relatively, you know, small or maybe I'll even say maybe less significant evidences. I hope I'm phrasing that right. But I guess two would be, it seems like you're simply equivocating extraordinary for supernatural. Like you said, you know, the contradictions with Caesar, the contradictions with Nero, the reason that you accept those and reject, you know, you accept those contradictions because it's a natural event, but you reject, you know, the discrepancies in the Gospels because it's a supernatural claim. So explain to me why extraordinary isn't just a equivocation for supernatural.
Well, I just told you that winning the lottery is extraordinary. And as far as I can tell, that's not. Now, it would be supernatural if I won the lottery because I don't play the lottery, because I apparently don't care about education in Texas. That's what they tell me.
Well, I guess my point is, you know, it seems like the only thing that you would reject, or the only thing that seems extraordinary, on your grounds, it seems to be an epistemology to a bias against the supernatural. And so when you say extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, it just seems like it's incredulity just repackaged.
Well, until we can provide evidence that anything supernatural exists or that supernatural events occur, there's no reason for me to accept the supernatural. With that being said, evidence could be, I think, extraordinary evidence could be provided for it. I just answered that. I have no idea. I don't know. We've never seen the evidence that can corroborate something that's supernatural, right? We don't have, and for the thing of Jesus, we don't have the corroborating, external stories about the resurrection of Jesus. We don't have that at all. We don't have anything that's against, like anybody that would have been against them saying that Jesus was resurrected, right? We don't have a lot of sources. In fact, we really only have two sources of the resurrection of Jesus, of the story of Jesus. There's only two sources, and it'd be Book of Mark and then the Book of John, and only the Book of John only because if God exists, he knew I would read it and like it one day. The sources that say anything about the resurrection of Jesus are, they make the claims, are super skewed. They're all in the Bible. They all are telling their own narrative. It's like when if I'm telling the story of Thanos inside of Avengers, am I actually telling the story of Thanos from an opposing view? No, I'm telling the story of Thanos from my view as my personal Captain America, right? And so these things are not lining up to the evidence that we would need. All it is for supernatural or extraordinary claim. The extraordinary claim is that Jesus did the one thing that nobody has ever done in the history of life on the planet, and that's rise from the dead. This is not one in 300 million. This is one in ever.
But you're saying on one hand, the evidence doesn't match what we would need to corroborate the story. And then on the other hand, you're saying, well, I don't even know what evidence I would need to believe a supernatural claim. So you can't have it both ways. You can't on one hand say, I don't know what evidence I would need. And then on the other hand say, well, there's no evidence that corroborates the story for the Gospels. You can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, it wouldn't meet the standard that we need for a supernatural event. And then on the other hand say, well, I don't even know what evidence I would need for a supernatural event to believe it.
Well, let me ask you this. Are there currently, to your knowledge, any extra biblical accounts? We already know there are no contemporary accounts, period. But are there any extra biblical accounts that exist that speak to the resurrection of Jesus as if it were historical?
As if it were historical? So,
as if it happened.
I would say that you have, I think as far as I know, you have church fathers that talk about the resurrection. They don't provide like firsthand accounts, their second, third hand accounts. You've got their accounts, legends that come afterwards, like the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter, or the Apocalypse of Peter. But those are built upon a core legend and a core understanding that go back to, what's talked about in the Gospels. But my case is not, there's a bunch of extra biblical texts that talk about the resurrection of Jesus. I'm simply saying, what's the best explanation for the claims that are made and the facts that a majority, not a consensus, but a majority of scholars agree upon? That's the claim that I'm making, the minimal facts claim. And it just doesn't seem.
Habermas actually walked back the claim of the empty tomb. The majority of scholars don't accept that. It would need something outside of the text that makes the claim, and there is nothing.
Nathaniel, that's not necessarily true whatsoever. You can look at the text and you can say, hey, the disciples said they had an appearance. What's the best explanation for the disciples saying that they saw the risen Jesus? What's the best explanation there? Now, real quick, one last question. If you go over for a minute, if that's okay, I'd like to go over for at least one more minute.
Sure.
So, Nathaniel, you said earlier that James, ended up becoming a follower because he didn't want to tarnish his family name. But in the gospel account,
I said something that I thought about earlier today, and it may not be close to reality. But it's more likely that he wanted to not tarnish the family name, such as that of Joseph Smith's family, than he saw somebody raised from the dead.
But the thing about that, the issue with that though, Nathaniel, is that that Jesus's family thought that he was tarnishing the name because they thought he was crazy.
That's only in the Bible.
Okay.
Seriously.
I can move on.
I asked you a question.
Go ahead.
Which one is more likely, that James wanted to protect his family name or that he saw Jesus rise from the dead?
He saw Jesus rise from the dead, given the biblical data. Okay. And the best explanation for what accounts for those facts that I laid out.
So you and I have a fundamental disagreement upon what most likely means. But okay.
Oh, I got a little heated there towards the end. I like it. I like it. excellent job to both of you. I'll read the super chats here in just a second. I believe Steve has a question or two that he'd like to lay out real quick.
Steve's going to trash me right here.
Probably. Steve, you're muted.
Steve needs to unmute to trash you.
Oh, how about that? Let's try this. No, this is more of a thing to both of you because I think both of you guys are equivocating this. This aphorism of extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, I think a lot of people do misunderstand. There is a type of ordinary evidence that we have for ordinary things we observe, right? One person is using it one way, but when you bring up this certain statement, this was something that Carl Sagan used. And what he meant it by was not so much something that is out of the ordinary. For example, you use the lottery. We use an everyday kind of a colloquial expressions that would be extraordinary because we won the lottery. If you take a deck of cards and you shuffle them and you turn them face up, that arrangement, that sequence is 52 factorial or 1 to the 10 to the 67th power to 1. It's huge. It's rare, right? It's extraordinary. But that's not how Sagan used this term or this aphorism. What Sagan used this aphorism to mean is that we have no existing evidence to account for an observation. There has to be something new. So when Nathaniel's talking about the resurrection of Jesus, right? Jesus coming back from the dead is extraordinary in the Sagan sense. I'm not speaking for Nathaniel, but this is what the Sagan would say. He was saying, we have no evidence to show that this was ever something that was possible. We need new evidence, extraordinary evidence to substantiate that claim, something that is not in our purview as of yet. That's how this phrase or this aphorism was used. Does that make sense? Because I think you guys were equivocating the phrase itself. That's how Sagan would have actually used it. Maybe that's how Nathaniel, I'm not sure. Did you agree with that? Okay. Just because something's extraordinary doesn't really mean much, right? I won the lottery. Sure, it's a huge claim, but it's not beyond what we consider to be mundanely ordinary. So you got to be careful how you use the term extraordinary. As long as you recognize there's ordinary, mundane, extraordinary, and then there's extraordinary as a fact we have not accounted for these things yet. We haven't seen these things. We have no explanation for them yet. That's the Sagan way of interpreting it. Anyway,
I'll give you a good example. Here's a good example of that. It would be extraordinary if Russian vids had have taken up that opportunity to go and watch the launch.
No, that would have been a fucking miracle.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Dean doesn't know what we're talking
about. Yeah. Okay. Was that all?
They don't know.
It's okay. Mueller report. Mueller report. I don't know. Okay. That's all I'm going to
say. All right. Let's move to the super chats here. Let me pull those up. And okay, starting us out, RJ, I can't believe Kwiasa made that pick so messed up. I'm not sure what pick that is. Maybe you can share. Trevor Hudson, 7 times Josephus, 8 times Tacitus. Well, Steve, you're going shirtless. Sandrine. Person, I'm sorry, but only 5 tonight. I had other things I had to buy today, but I still wanted to show my support for what you guys do. Love you. Well, we love you too, sir. I'm gonna have your. I'm doing a avatar for Sandrine that I think is gonna be killer. So look out for that. That'll be coming probably tomorrow. Frank McAvoy, I'm ushering the Easter Vigil at St. Patrick's in D.C. Vigil starts at 8 p.m. Come by. We all have a good time at St. Patrick's. Cool.
Is there alcohol?
I'm guessing. Yeah. I would think so. Let us know, Frank. Confite, the Bible paints Pilate in a very positive light. He listens to the Jews' request, yet he was written in other texts to be rather harsh to people under his rule. How does Dean reconcile this?
I've never even thought about that. I think that there could be a situation where The Gospels are recording that Pilate's giving into mob pressure given the Passover. And that also Pilate was just a pretty crude, rude dude, you know, in general. So I don't see that there's a discrepancy there with the way that they're describing Pilate here and other historical records. I mean, you have really bad guys that are in history that do give in to mob rule. So.
Okay. I have an answer to that.
Sure.
So Perfectus Pilate, I think he came from Syria. I think so. I know that Judea certainly was not a very compared to at least Syria and Egypt was not something that we want to go to. And so Pilate came in with no legions, right? He had no soldiers with him at all whenever he came and had to basically because he wasn't there to turn the Jews into Romans, but he was there to kind of like keep the peace, if you will, and to put down insurrection, which is kind of a big deal whenever you consider the Messiah was coming, that the Jews thought that. And so he didn't actually really have any power necessarily. He was there kind of like, almost like Quirinius was in the beginning of around 6 CE, really just to kind of do tax purpose things and to make sure everybody stayed in line. Caiaphas, who took over after Annas was deposed, actually had more power than Pilate. And so Pilate, he would try and kind of reassert himself by coming in and doing these types of things and sometimes making up stories as to why he was crucifying people. And he would just sometimes crucify people for seemingly the fun of it, but just to show he was rarely in Jerusalem. And that's one of the main reasons that the supposed trial had to happen when on a certain day, because he was there during the Passover. He was coming through and then leaving, but it had to go through Caiaphas. The whole thing did. Now, there's never anything that the Jews would be like, hey, this is one of our traditions that we're going to, you know, son of the father is going to come and be, traded over for Jesus or anything like that. But Pontius Pilate was not very powerful, but he still had the ability to crucify people. And he did it just so he could keep his tenuous hold. And he was already he'd been reported anyway. He was on his way out. So.
I want to convey a message that was just said in the live chat from the Lord Watch Commander Apologist Supreme. He says that you're using the David Hume argument again for the 20th time tonight. Let me debate this guy. Well, Sir Master Apologist, you'll get your chance here coming up because we could do that in the after show. So it won't be a completely you one-on-one, but you can raise whatever issues that you had in the after show. Okay, My Unfinished Journey, thank you for the super chat, says Brains. I think that was a zombie reference. Lucy Fur says, just found you and have been binge watching. Love your content. Thank you, Lucy. I'm glad to have you. My Unfinished Journey, there are worse things than Wilhelm Craig. Who's better? BTTR, who's better? I'm going to say anyone. Anybody else?
Yeah. I know. Dean, didn't you go to his school or something like that?
I'm at Biola right now. I had a class on atonement with Wilhelm.
I am so sorry.
No offense.
He's a pretty cool dude. He actually showed up for class a couple weeks. Was it a couple weeks or a couple days after hip surgery?
Well, sure.
Being tough.
Yeah.
Psychic. I was like,
this has been such a quaint stream, and everybody's gotten along. So I'm gonna do what I normally don't do and just bite my tongue. Yeah, William Lane Craig, I'm sure, is a really nice guy. Really nice guy. just kidding. Antonio Aurora says that. Wink, or what's that?
Just kidding. Is that like nice guy? Like wink, wink. Just kidding. Is that what that is?
No, it's okay. I don't really know him. I just I don't. I think he. I think he debates dishonestly at times. I've seen to where he holds to things that are just demonstrably and clearly the opposite of what he's saying, but I don't know him on a personal level, so I can't really speak to, you know, how he is as an individual. Antonio Arroyo says, I can't deal with the rehashing of this argument right now. Happy long weekend, heathens. I'm going to watch hockey. Brian G, any accounts of Caesar being stabbed say he horse? Say he horse.
Not that I know of. Oh, Dean, you never, I don't, I'm sorry, Kyle, I don't mean to interrupt you. Dean, you never, didn't you say that you had, that you believe there was just as much historical evidence for Caesar crossing the Rubicon as for Jesus resurrecting?
I could have. I don't remember, to be honest with you. I have no idea. If you throw up a video or a link where I said it, I'll say sure. But I just don't remember.
Okay. I was just wondering because I found that to be rather extraordinary. So,
well, I'll tell you this. We know Caesar existed because he has one hell of a salad, and there is not a thing called a Jesus salad. So in that competition, Caesar takes it. All hell Caesar. Yeah. Larry Walter Jr. says, in a century from now, all historians will laugh at us for the endless debates over ancient mythos between the lady and those seeking reason or rationale. Maybe so. Brian Shannon didn't leave a message, but thank you for the super chat. Brian G, question for Dean. What was the Roman custom for crucifixion and burial for criminals?
Yeah, so the Roman custom for crucifixion, nails, scourging before that, nails. And as far as I know, the standard custom was to put them in a mass grave. However, Quintilian and Josephus talks about the piercing. Josephus says that until 68 AD, the standard custom for Jews was to allow them to be buried. Because 68 to 70 is the siege of Jerusalem. And so they start to denigrate the Jews by not allowing those who have been crucified to get proper burial rites. That's Jewish Wars 4, I believe.
Okay. And let's see. Brian G. would compare winning the lottery to a supernatural event such as rising from the dead. I think Steve hit on that. Let me make sure. Oh, okay. We got a couple more. Jacob Neeson says, just had a big scare, but it all worked out. So I feel like super chatting. Thought I had lost my Marvel comic collection, but everything was restored. Ooh, that would be rough. Kwiasa, some nice Christians gave me a pair of boiled eggs to commemorate Easter, but the eggs in our country are brown and it looks like a pair of balls. Oh man. And from SJ, thanks tonight, Steve and Kyle. I enjoyed this. You're welcome. Thank you to our guests and debaters who did a fantastic job. I'll let you guys take a second and plug your channels or your social media where people can follow you. If you'll give us probably 15 minutes, we will be back with an after show where we'll be joined by Apologia, Godless Engineer, Shannon, Casey, the whole gang, and hopefully our two guests, Master Supreme, Apologist General, and maybe Andrew. So, Steve, before I let these two gentlemen chill out, is there anything that you need to say before we kick off for the
People have been bugging me for a rum and coke night quite a bit extensively lately, so tomorrow night I think I'll have one. So I don't know what you guys got planned, but probably right after whatever they do here, and then tomorrow, let's get drunk tomorrow. Sound good? Get drunk and just have a rum and coke night on my channel.
Hell yeah, celebrate the resurrection.
celebrated. Celebrated. Yeah. Yeah, we'll call it the pre Easter. What is it? What's the Sunday? It's Good Friday, and Sunday is
Holy Sunday.
Let's all stumble, for He is risen. There's our tagline.
It is, and Dean, it is more likely they got drunk and thought they saw it than he actually rose from the dead.
Easter Sunday. Maybe.
Yeah, Easter Sunday. Easter. Yeah, it's Easter.
Yeah, maybe.
The holiday is called Easter, Steve.
Yeah, but I was thinking what they call it for the Sundays. Easter Sunday. Yeah. I don't know why I couldn't put those words together.
Nathaniel, go ahead and plug yourself however you'd like to.
that's
crazy.
Turn off the screen.
What's early? I did not mean it like that. Oh, I'm so happy that I said it that way, but sorry.
No, you're fine. I was talking, I was writing, and I was writing about like the hallucinations and things like that. And the first thing I wrote was apologia for turning me on. And I didn't write to this. And so it's like turning me on the hallucinations. And I was like,
well, that's understandable. He turns all of us on.
Right. So I don't have a YouTube channel yet. I don't know why. Dean told me to make one too. I do have a Twitter. Yeah. If you want to talk about politics and religion, you can find me at Atheist Husker. If you like sports, which apparently like no atheists like sports. What's wrong with you people? I'm gonna go back to being a Christian. They like sports. I'm at Nathaniel Husker. And if you like corgis, I have two of them, and they're at Dose Corgis 15. That's where you can find me.
Excellent. And Ding.
Yeah, real quick before I, you know, do the shameless advertisement, because I don't want to say plugs. I just want to thank Steve and Kyle. You know, as a Christian, I know that we have different worldviews, different opinions, and Nathaniel as well. Just because I think non sequitur is a really good place for people, for the most part, to come and have a cordial conversation. I'm glad that is an avenue for both believers and non-believers, because I think right now the biggest thing that we've got to figure out is, even with these differences of opinions, how to like coexist with each other. And so I think this is a good avenue for that to take place. Like, thank Nathaniel for setting this up, and you know, appreciative of the job that he's done. As far as me, on Instagram, at The Daily Apologist. YouTube channel, we're looking to rework that though. So it's still The Daily Apologist. Twitter is, take a guess, Daily Apologist. Facebook page, The Daily Apologist. And that's it for the shameless plugs. So if you have any questions or anything like that, just hit me up on a DM on Facebook or on Twitter. I'll be more than happy to have a conversation. And Kyle, I look forward to having you in Greensboro.
Oh yeah, we definitely need to do that. Thank you for those kind words. To me, I always sort of, in one way it's disheartening, but in another way it's kind of nice to be a place that allows for discussions, because somewhere along the way, people forgot to have a conversation with each other that disagree. And it's amazing sometimes the sort of, I guess the best word would be novelty that people look at the channel sometimes, because we have so many different conversations about so many different things, but all it really boils down to is just two people that disagree on something having a conversation. And sometimes it turns out well, like tonight, and sometimes it is just a complete and utter inferno in a landfill. And we love both of them. Yes, exactly. Very good cue on the graphics there. But I liked your caveat there. This is a good place for conversation for the most part. And I think that I'm going to put that on a shirt, because that is no truer words that have ever been spoken.
There you go.
Okay. So we'll be, by the way, Artisan Tony left a super chat. Thank you for the super chat, Artisan Tony. This says, happy Easter to all, but still fuck you, Tony. And we'll be back here in 15 minutes with the after show. We'll be joined by Paula Gia, Godless Engineer, Super Master Supreme, Grand Wizard, Elite Apologist, maybe Andrew, and our two guests. So we'll be back here in just a few.
All right.